Today, I'm in Yellowstone Park, and I wish I were dead. Who said that, and why?
So that's, of course, Rudyard Kipling. And this is Rudyard Kipling in July of 1889. He's on a tour across America. Specifically, he's stopping at Livingston and then going down into Yellowstone Park. And he's very much a child of the British Empire. So he wants to put the Americans in their place. And he's particularly upset because it's the 4th of July, and so there are American flags everywhere, and everybody's being obnoxiously American.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Ken Egan about his historical nonfiction book, Montana 1889, Indians, Cowboys, and Miners in the Year of Statehood. We'll begin by diving into the mythology of the West. So this book is your follow-up to your previous book about the year Montana became a territory called Montana 1864. Why did you need to write this book, Montana 1889?
It's a great question. And the truth is, I wanted to tell the rest of the story. I should add that there was demand for it, I'll be frank. So when I toured with 1864, I literally went all over the state. And it was a joy, really. So went from, as I say, from Broadus to Eureka. And many, many people said, well, what happened in the year of statehood? What difference did those 25 years make? And I suddenly discovered that was a really interesting question. And it was a chance, frankly, to look at a part of America that underwent transformation, radical transformation in a short period of time. We could see it happening in the late 19th century. I was also extremely intrigued by what happened to the Native nations, of course, as a result of those changes. And in many ways, that was the most heartrending, most revealing, and in some interesting ways, the most encouraging aspects of the research. So anyway, felt the need to do this kind of before and after for Montana. What's it like at territory in 1864? What's it like at statehood in 89? What changes can we track, can we mark through the lives of interesting people?
I'm really glad you brought up the indigenous component because I want to linger there a bit later. But one of the things in the press package I got about this book, it establishes the following, which is that between 1864 and 1889, the buffalo were exterminated, the Indian Wars ended, tribal nations were confined to reservations, cattle and sheep by the tens of thousands grazed the open range, Butte, Montana exploded into a city with electricity and millionaires, and multiple railroads connected Montana to the world. That's some of the changes that you're talking about.
Absolutely. So what you have to imagine is Gilded Age America comes to the outback. That's really what's happening. So following the Civil War, you have this incredible surge of money, energy, capitalism, desire just surging onto the high plains. And here's Montana, which is in many ways from certain points of view ready for the taking. So you have this influx of individuals who have the means, the desire, and the laws in order to come in here and impose their will. And so in many ways, it's a very heartening story. And one thing that I do want to emphasize is the number of women who are featured in the book. And I will tell you that that is largely a result of demand from readers, because when I toured with 1864, many readers said, where are the women? And it was a legitimate point. Mm-hmm. But I mention the women in part because one of the really striking themes that emerged for me is that women often found these gaps in social convention that allowed them to test out possibilities that were not available to them in other places. So
the book starts with this statement, though, that caught me off guard. You write, the American West was born on the plains of Montana in the 1880s.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
I love it. I meant that to be provocative and kind of shocking. So we live, you know, with the aftermath of the American Western, the cowboy story primarily. And of course, we're living at a moment of tremendous, what we might call kind of counter-Westerns, that is very sophisticated revisions, retakes on the Western. But the point is that the Western, the cowboy story, is a myth that was generated by a settler culture, by the Americans, largely in order to come to terms with the changes we've just been talking about. And in many ways, let's be honest, the cowboy story is a way of concealing some of the more scary, frightening, disturbing elements of change. And so if the cowboy becomes this kind of figure, this romantic figure, a knight of the plains, almost, if you will, a white Indian, and then what you have then is this sense that true, we may have displaced indigenous nations, but we've brought onto the plains then these charismatic representatives of the American way who also, as it were, carry some of those more indigenous elements. Now, we can unpack that. We can take that apart. Yeah. But anyway, so that's what I'm referring to. And in the book proper, you can see how a Theodore Roosevelt, who spends time in Western Dakota, Eastern Montana, he is very much about generating that myth. We have Charlie Russell emerging at this very moment. We have Teddy Blue Abbott emerging at this moment. We have Bertha Muzzy Bauer writing Westerns. All of that is happening right now at this moment.
The beginning of the book also hosts visions.
Yes.
And to speak to this concealment or this, there's sort of this haunting quality.
Mm-hmm.
The last sentence of the first vision, which was spoken by Plenty Coo to Frank Linderman in 1930, was, "You saw what happened to us when the buffalo went away." Why did you include these voices?
Yeah, so one of the things I'm trying to do is to allow space for multiple points of view on what happened in Montana during those 25 years we've been talking about. And so I use the visions as kind of introductory insights into these different points of view. In the case of Plenty Coo, it is a haunting statement from a pre-reservation Indian chief, leader, visionary, who now has to adjust to the reality of the reservation. We have a number of other visions in there. We have James J. Hill, who probably a lot of folks would know, but he covers the whole region. He's not just a Montana figure. Uh-huh. He covers the region because he builds the Great Northern Railway. Mm-hmm. His vision is of a paradise found, primarily an economic paradise. And then we have Frank Linderman, who's an extraordinary character. And Frank Linderman is talking to an old trapper who basically says Montana has gone to hell now, that it's a state, right? Mm-hmm. So the visions are meant to, as it were, kind of lay down these different possibilities for the Montana that's emerging, and I hope kind of inspire the reader with an openness. We have to allow for multiple voices. We have to recognize that there are parallel lives going forward.
Right, and the intersection, one of the intersections that I noticed was both the romanticism of indigenous ways and then also this pressure to exterminate,
yes,
you know, and to civilize.
Yes. Yes. And that is one of the big takeaways. And I hope as people read through the book, and I have to tell you, one of the joys for me as a writer is this is told month by month, a series of stories or collage-like effect. And what I'm hoping happens is readers are making their own connections, their own discoveries as they move through the book. And so one of the great discoveries, honestly, is that there were multiple points of view on how to, quote unquote, deal with the Indian issue, mm-hmm, even within the dominant American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a George Bird Grinnell, who in many ways is a liberal and is trying desperately to help the Piegan Blackfeet, for example. At the same time, he is very much committed to this so-called civilizing function. You have other individuals who are much more aggressive, frankly, about dealing with the issue militarily. You have a certain set of folks out of Miles City who want to eliminate the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in 1889. Multiple points of view. And again, I'm hopeful that I'm creating this space where readers can appreciate all that kind of divergence and difference and conflict. It's a very roiling kind of conflict-laden but fascinating time.
Did you find that it served you to break it down into both 1 year and then chapters by the month in order to give yourself some limits?
It did. That's a very, very good way of putting it. One reason, I'll be frank with you, one reason I use this format, people always ask, as they should, why break it down by months? Well, the honest answer is I tried writing a straightforward narrative history, just telling the story of Montana for 1864, the first book, and I found I wasn't very good at it. It was just dull writing. That when I shifted to these anecdotes, to these stories about individuals, that the prose seemed to take on more spark, more life, more immediacy. So I really liked that. Besides that, I do want to get a sense of the flow of time through 1889 And so what you'll discover is, for example, I introduced right away Marcus Daly, who was one of the so-called Copper Kings. He was a major, major figure in Butte. He arrived in about 1876 and becomes one of the leading copper magnates. He creates the town of Anaconda. In many ways, he is key to extending the power of Butte across the state of Montana, in fact, across the whole Northwest. So Marcus Daly is introduced in January and then becomes a kind of recurring figure throughout the whole book. So that was another effect I was hoping for. Something else a reader pointed out to me, actually, in one of my readings recently, he said that it felt to him like I was giving folks a sense of seasonal change in Montana. And that was very interesting. So what's happening in summer in, say, cattle country and on the reservations versus, say, November, December? And that is intriguing. Mm-hmm. So just in terms of lived life on the plains.
That was another question I had for you, is how did the landscape, the physical landscape of Montana change in 1889?
Dramatic. What really, I think the big event there, obviously, is the elimination of the great animals, which occurs officially. The last buffalo is killed in 1883, something like that. So by 1889, of course, you have the elimination, but you also have active processes to eliminate wolves, to eliminate elk herds, etc. And basically, if you're trying to build a cattle industry or a sheep industry, you desire to create space that is safe for your critters, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And so that's happening. But the real biggie is Butte is now starting to explode. It is truly starting to blow up. And what's happening is it's both silver and copper in 1889, but pretty soon, as a lot of folks would know, probably pretty soon copper is going to become the dominant metal. And so what's happening is you have the Butte mining powers like Daly. He's reaching out to create a Great Falls, right, in order to do all the smelting. He's helping to build a Red Lodge, Montana, to extract coal to serve his work. You have A.B. Hammond in Missoula, Montana, who's harvesting all this timber in order to feed this massive thing called the mining industry. Incredible. A lot of the scars on the land we see today actually date back to that era.
Speaking of cattle, there were some terms in the book that I want to ask you about.
Yeah, this will be fun. Good.
What is a cowpuncher?
A cowpuncher is literally just a cowboy, and it's another kind of a vernacular phrase, a comfortable, folky phrase for someone, and a cow puncher, and you can think, they're actually putting the brand on these animals. And it's a little more physical than that. And I have to be clear for my audience, I've spent all of 2 days total working on a ranch, so I do not want to pretend. But in that experience, what I did notice, it's a very physical activity where you're literally, having to force animals into certain situations in order to brand them, for example.
And Montana's famous artist Charlie Russell was a nighthawk.
He was a nighthawk.
What is a nighthawk?
So this is a wonderful thing. Charlie Russell, I think we tend to think of him as a great cowboy. In fact, he was a terrible cowboy. I think we need to recognize that Charlie was not a great cowboy. So a nighthawk, his job was simply to watch the herd by night and make sure everything was calm and copacetic, right? And so he was not one of the stars, He wasn't a Teddy Blue Abbott who was a real deal.
A real cowboy. What is the medicine line?
The medicine line actually refers to the Canadian border. And the medicine line is critical because, of course, I think one thing that I discovered working on these two books, 64 and 89, is how artificial all of our political units like states and countries are. They're made up. They're drawn on the map, right? Mm-hmm. And so the medicine line refers to the Canadian border. And it's medicine line because for Native peoples, crossing that line had profound impact. And the one example I'll just mention briefly is Louis Riel and the Métis people, along with their Chippewa Cree allies. And for them, they were often crossing the medicine line for strategic reasons. In some cases, frankly, to evade the law in Canada after they participated in some resistance movements. In some cases, they're just seeking the best access to bison herds. They were particularly fond of the Milk River country up on the High Line, what we call the High Line. And they loved it there because they had kind of settlements there, and it was an opportunity. So very critical. Another example that some folks from around the region would be familiar with is when Sitting Bull flees, and it has to be said, after the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, he'll cross the medicine line into Canada in order to protect him and his people from the American military. And we could discuss that at length. But anyway, so that's another example of the medicine line and its impact. Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's dive in. I want to understand, or can you help us understand the primary conflict at the time between, you know, white conquest and indigenous people?
Absolutely. So what you have now, and again, we have to understand this is a 25-year process now, that it's with the explosion of gold mining in the region in 1862 through 64, you have an incredible inrush in migration of all these immigrants from around the country. They're bringing with them very aggressive, both military and economic processes, and they're very impatient. In many cases, frankly, those initial immigrants were here to grab wealth and get out. What's happening then following the Civil War is you have many more immigrants who are coming in trying to establish an economic base and to stay here. And what that means, particularly in the case of the cattle industry, is that you have these plains, these and valleys, right? Missoula, Dillon, et cetera. These are wonderful places as well for cattle. But you have these quote-unquote open spaces that have been claimed by indigenous peoples largely for bison hunting and other forms of subsistence living. So what you have then is this desire to clear the space of those wild animals we talked about earlier, the bison, elk, wolves, etc., but also to clear those spaces of native peoples so that you can run vast herds of cattle. And of course, that's why the railroads are critical. You bring the railroads in so you can ship your cattle back to processing plants, particularly in Chicago, for example.
Roosevelt. You write a couple sentences that really caught my attention. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt represents with unusual clarity the confident belief in the American mission to colonize and tame the West. Unapologetic, surprisingly unself-reflective for such an intelligent man, Roosevelt embraces the racialist belief that Anglo-American culture fulfilled its world historical destiny by conquering, quote, savages and installing American institutions in the West.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you summarize Roosevelt's...
He's such an extraordinary man. And he's a wonderful example of the kind of paradox or dilemma you find yourself when you plunge into this history. Because let's face it, there's a lot to admire about Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Incredible energy, incredible vision, right? And I, for one, admire the fact that he believed in creating spaces such as national parks. I admired that. And just a sense of mission, purpose, and all of that. At the same time, wedded to that is this real deep belief that Anglo-Americans really are the future. And that means that you have to eclipse, displace, overwhelm, defeat other peoples, and in particular, native peoples, indigenous nations. And he's unapologetic about that. I mean, he's actually publishing in 1889, he's publishing a series of books, The Winning of the West, which makes this argument overtly. There's no attempt to conceal. And again, I have to tell you, I admire that about Roosevelt. He's rarely hypocritical. He's just straightforward. So Winning of the West just argues straightforwardly. It's the American destiny to carry quote-unquote civilization to the plains and to impose, and will be a better world for that. And by the way, he does believe that indigenous peoples will be better for it as well, something we, of course, could have a great argument about. But that is Theodore Roosevelt. And he had spent time, just to be clear for folks who don't know, he had spent time in the mid-80s on a ranch in western North Dakota. It's following the death of his wife and mother, and he's just bereft. And for him, he felt like he was rejuvenated, revived through his time in the West. He very much played cowboy. He very much played frontiersman. And it allowed him, I think, to give a kind of energy, a kind of credibility to his beliefs, right? And again, it goes back to the creation of the Western we talked about earlier. He's very much part of that because he really, really believed it. And I think that's something else I have to admit, that going into the writing of 1889, I thought I would see a lot of folks who were almost making it up or pretending, or that there was something disingenuous about some of these beliefs, which we now often find abhorrent. Mm-hmm. I think Teddy was all in. He believed it to his core and to his dying day, I believe.
Yeah. What's it like for you then to hold competing understandings of these characters?
Yeah. Well, in many ways, that's human beings, of course.
True.
And in the end, that's what I think, honestly. I do. I think these are human beings who are confronting challenges, opportunities, historical change, and they do what human beings do. They analyze to the best of their ability. They're acting on prejudice or presumption. They are, you know, often innovating. They're making it up on the fly. And so part of me admires that grit, that toughness. I have to say that, you know. And in other words, when I look at a Theodore Roosevelt, it's easy to make fun of him when you see him in his buckskins and all that.
Dressed up.
The truth is, people who knew him at the time, who we would now say are credible cowboys, Teddy Blue Abbott again, they saw him as a pretty effective Westerner, as someone who, you know, put his heart into it and tried hard and had great hustle, as we would say. And so that's really how I respond to these complex characters. I say they're very human. I do make judgments. I don't want to kid anybody. A person who might pick up this book will discover that I definitely do make some judgments. And and you can just guess my judgment about Theodore Roosevelt's view of Western settlement.
That's what I want to know, too, is like, when did you know that you were going to take a stand and make, you know, insert an opinion into this, you know, it's fairly straightforward nonfiction book. But when did you know you were like, I'm on this side of history?
Yeah. So it's a very important question. Thanks for asking it, Sarah. So what I will tell you is that I did a ton of research for about a year and a half. And then I started putting the book together and selecting historical figures and putting them in their slots, their different months and all that. And I did see patterns emerging. And so as a writer, I felt I had some obligation to the reader to give some through lines, some thematic threads. And so I'll just very briefly indicate the three that occurred to me. The first was the way Montana and the West in general is being incorporated into global and national networks. And again, we're talking the Gilded Age, the imposition of these economic processes, and the creation of these railroad systems. And so Montana and other northern tier states are being pulled into these networks, and it totally alters the game here. Because it's no longer the case that you can have, I'll take a figure out of Montana lore, a John Owen, who had an extraordinary ranch, farm, fort up the Bitterroot Valley. This is in western Montana now. And he was in many ways on his own. That could never be again as a result of that incorporation. Second big theme is the imposition of the reservation system that we've talked about. The third is the creation of the Western to, in a sense, account for and even cover up these changes. So I did find myself wanting to reinforce those themes as I was composing the book and revising it. That's primarily when I kind of, if you will, state an opinion. Sometimes I have to say characters are so darn quirky, or I should say historical figures are so quirky that they inspire a thought, a conclusion. But generally, I try to give three-dimensional views.
Sure. If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Ken Egan about his nonfiction book, Montana 1889, Indians, Cowboys, and Miners in the Year of Statehood. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So you bring in another storyteller, Andrew Garcia, who wrote Tough Trip Through Paradise.
Absolutely.
Will you talk a little bit about his story and also this term whitewash?
Yes, very, very good. So Andrew Garcia is kind of an ideal figure in this book for all the reasons we've already talked about. We use the term paradoxical. Mm-hmm. We talk about the fact that people bring very mixed motives to the region, to the high plains, the mountain valleys. We talk about people who have very complicated emotions surrounding the Native nations. Andrew Garcia is the perfect embodiment of that. And if folks don't know him, he's most famous for the book Tough Trip Through Paradise, an extraordinary book and typically thought of as one of the top 10 books ever to come out of this place called Montana. And Garcia's story is he arrives in Montana in the 1870s, and he participates in the effort and frankly, the successful effort to capture the Nez Perce, who are on a long journey out of Idaho up through the Yellowstone Park country, heading for the Canadian border or the Medicine Line. And he helps to capture them at the Bear's Paw Mountains. It's pretty horrific. Any account of it is horrific. Well, after that, following that, he takes the money he made from that. He invests in a trading business on the Musselshell River, which is in central Montana, for those who don't know. And he falls in love with Inez Pierce woman in Hulice. And everything changes. Mm-hmm. So talk about flipping the script. Talk about reversing angle of view or perspective. So he goes from being the one who captures these people in a brutal manner to the one who understands fully and heartbreakingly what it was like to be on that journey. So that is Andrew Garcia. And to his credit, he wanted to tell that story. Mm-hmm. He saw it as his mission to tell that right. story. He's also interesting because a number of the main figures in the book, a Granville Stewart, for example, they married Indian wives, and that did change their perspective. Mm-hmm. However, by 1889, many of those marriages are no longer considered legitimate, appropriate, proper. So you see characters like Andrew Garcia, Granville Stewart, moving on, moving toward respectability. And I think it tells us a lot of how the region is changing and how you have these new values being imposed.
In regards to Garcia, you write, Garcia by no means absolves Indian peoples of their own forms of cruelty, for he has witnessed occasions of their gratuitous violence. Instead, he's offended by the tendency to whitewash American conquest with Western romantic fables and military glory.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I do want to be clear, he does describe what I would call atrocities on the part of Native peoples as well. But what Garcia is really frustrated with is that, you see, he gets to see the emergence of the Western, the cowboy story. He gets to see how that story suddenly converts people who are often very violent toward other peoples, converts those individuals into romantic heroes. He is appalled by that. He's absolutely anti-romantic. If I could have, I'm just for the heck of it, I'll mention this. If I could get two male individuals in a room together from this book, mm-hmm. I would want Frank Linderman and Andrew Garcia to speak to each other, because I think Andrew Garcia would be so impatient with Frank Linderman, who's the ultimate romantic, who really believes we can go back to some pure original state of nature. And I think Garcia would just be appalled by that. So Garcia, as you read through Tough Trip Through Paradise, there are many moments he'll stop and he'll say, here's another lie. Here's another funny story we told ourselves. Here's another romantic fable we made up in order. He's very conscious about that. That is part of what Garcia took it as his job to do, is just to disable those thoughts.
And if I could have dinner with any character from your book, I would be terrified, but I would choose Mary Gleason Glynne.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Can I ask why you choose
Mary? Because she seems like a firecracker.
She is a firecracker.
You write about Mary's fits of rage.
Yes. Yes.
Can you just briefly describe her character?
You bet. So Mary Gleason Glynne, the reason she's in the book is because she and her husband, who I describe as a hapless man, kind of brainless fool. Anyway, they start buying buildings in the town of Missoula, Montana, and those buildings are clearly being used for what we might call, you know, illegal purposes. And so Mary Gleason Glynne, she is an Irish immigrant, by all accounts, highly intelligent. She's a large person, we have to say that, large person, and she does have a volcanic temper.
Yeah.
And the beauty of doing a book like 1889 is we have an incredible access now to newspapers. Those newspapers loved Mary Gleason Glynne because she was always great copy. Not only because she was carrying on illegal activities, she was kind of, you know, the madam of Missoula, Montana, but also because she gets into a series of violent scrapes. And frankly, if you read through kind of the colorful language, it's kind of disturbing stuff. I mean, she at one point takes a leg from a table and beats a man with it. That's not cool. Anyway, so she's fascinating because she also exposes some kind of the underbelly of 1889. And we have to understand this is still a pretty wide open, pretty crazy place. Mm-hmm. And so a town like a Missoula, again in western Montana, Missoula is a logging town. It's a crossroads town. It's a railroad town. And it's a place where there's a lot of male energy. And so Mary Gleason Glynne is responding to that, if you will. Sad end to her story, I will say. She ends up being convicted, going to Deer Lodge, which is the Montana State Prison. and ends up actually being beaten herself and never really recovers. So it's kind of a sad end.
In regards to, I'm just going to call it, say what it is. In regards to prostitution.
Yes.
You write that it's an important and even sanctioned business, yes, and the second largest business for women.
It is. Isn't that something?
What is the role of prostitution then in Montana statehood?
Yeah. So it really goes back to the discussion we were just having about Mary Gleason Glime. You can tell I love her name. So anyway, because basically you have a situation where you have a lot of single men who are unattached, they're unaffiliated. And of course, the imbalance between males and females in the territory is quite vast. And so prostitution serves a purpose, theoretically, in that it provides an outlet for a lot of that male energy, a lot of that kind of craziness and anarchy, et cetera. But I do have to stress there were very respectable businessmen like Anton Holter who were investing in prostitution. And so this notion that it's just a female figure like Mary Glime, there are a lot of people who are literally invested in it. And of course, you have your counter movements. And if anything, I wish I'd had more time and space for that. You have your counter movements. That is, you have religiously inclined folks who are trying to resist that element of the culture. But I guess, to be honest, their stories aren't quite as colorful.
Yeah. I remember once I asked you publicly if you had a certain or special attraction to one of your characters, if you mm-hmm. preferred one over the other. And I remember you said something like, no, I love them all. And I couldn't tell if that was because, number one, there are so many mentioned, or if that was sort of like the paternal way of saying, all my children, no one's the favored child here. But I am wondering if you can talk about some of the other women and minorities.
Yeah.
You have a fairly extensive piece on the Chinese Americans.
Yes.
And there are several notable Black women in your book.
Yes, exactly. So a brief comment about, that was funny. I do remember that occasion when you asked me. And it is true. I feel like they're all my children. I do feel that. But I will confess, for the record, Louis Riel, who is the Métis leader, is someone who's just incredibly interesting to me. So he's someone I might pursue at depth.
What's your draw to him?
Well, part of it is he's so mysterious. So here is this fascinating man. He's Métis, meaning mixed race, right? And again, it goes back to this theme of the mixed race people. And so he's highly intelligent. He gets an elite education in Canada. He helps lead resistance in what becomes Manitoba in the 1870s. He then has to go on the run because he's under threat of death because of what he did during that resistance in Manitoba. He comes to Montana and he actually spends officially 6 years here and he becomes an American citizen. He says at various points he'd like to remain an American citizen. He's pulled back north of the Medicine Line for a conflict in Saskatchewan and ultimately is put to death. Incredibly interesting man. So, and his in-betweenness is extremely interesting because in many ways, he's very judgmental of people on both sides. That is, he's very judgmental of the Europeans. He's very judgmental of the native peoples. In terms of other individuals in the book who just pull me in, Clara McAdoo is one of my all-time favorite characters. She's a businesswoman who migrated here from Michigan. She ends up running the Spotted Horse Mine up in the Judith Mountains. Incredible lady. Very powerful. By all accounts, a very direct, very smart, very opinionated person, and other women actually call her out. Lizzie Fisk will call out Clara McAdoo for being unladylike, so I admire her. I'm a big fan, actually, of Rose Gordon, who is the sister of Taylor Gordon, and I realize those names may not be familiar to a lot of people. She lived in White Sulphur Springs, which is in central Montana, a Black family. Her mother was a former slave. Her father was a Black immigrant from Scotland. She becomes kind of the, if you will, historian for White Sulphur Springs, and very moving. And you can get at her papers in places like the Montana Historical Society. Very moving. And she also wrote a lot of newspaper articles. And we can see how Rose is dealing with prejudice and yet truly rises above it. She's incredibly strong and resourceful. Very briefly, her brother Taylor was an incredible singer of Negro spirituals, and so that's how he became famous. I really admire him as well. Sarah Bickford rises to become the head of the water service in Virginia City, and she's an ex-slave. Mm-hmm. She migrates here as a servant. right? Mm-hmm. And then she ends up marrying a Stephen Bickford, who owns the water company in Virginia City. And lo and behold, he gives it to her in a will, and she becomes truly a powerful figure. And I want to go back to that theme we touched on earlier, where I do see women finding these spaces of opportunity, but it's not just women, it is minorities. Mm-hmm. And then last, just very briefly, on the Chinese, I have to credit a dear friend from Butte named Pat Munday, who is very active with the Maywa Institution or Museum in Butte. And Pat said to me, reading 1864, Ken, you've got to pay more attention to the Chinese. And I just so happened to find an extraordinary, awful newspaper article about an incident where a very prominent Chinese citizen is murdered. He's shot to death because he's in an opium den, and it's a ludicrous death. And that became, as it were, the anchor, the opening for me to write more about the Chinese in Montana.
Is any of this unique to Montana, or would you find this, you know, in Michigan state history or New Mexico state history?
Great question. Absolutely, this is not unique to Montana. In the case of the Chinese, the whole building of the Northern Pacific Railroad, that whole building process, one journalist says it well. He says that the railroad is built on the bones of the Chinese. Mm-hmm. And that is a theme certainly throughout the Northwest and the whole West, right? So that's certainly true. I think it is true, too, in terms of people finding these gaps or spaces mm-hmm. where they have an opportunity to perhaps take on roles they would never have in more settled, more quote-unquote, sophisticated, more stratified societies in the Midwest or the East. Absolutely. I think that's true throughout the West. Yeah.
Let's have you read a little section, and then I want to come back to how you end the book.
Sure.
Ken, I was thinking, I really liked the way you wrote about John Wesley Powell on 147.
Yeah. So one of my wonderful, surprising, personally satisfying discoveries as I was researching is that John Wesley Powell spoke to the Montana Constitutional Convention in August of 1889. And Powell has always been enormously interesting because he's most famous, frankly, for going down the Colorado River in 1869 in wooden boats. And he only has one arm. He lost an arm at Shiloh fighting on the Union side. So an extraordinary man. But, you know, he appears in Helena, Montana, 1889, and he's making an argument for a particular way of seeing the land. So I'll just read this, and hopefully folks will enjoy. The one-armed autodidact stands to speak to Montana's Constitutional Convention, now approaching the end of its efforts to create the document that will form a state. By any measure, the speaker is a remarkable man, a living embodiment of 19th century American ideals, an animated demonstration of the frontier virtues touted by Frederick Jackson Turner. John Wesley Powell is the son of British immigrants, ardent Methodists, hence John's middle name, who came of age in the upper Midwest when it was considered wilderness. He has a crackling mind that absorbs and synthesizes information at an almost overwhelming rate, so fast-paced that he struggles to put his ideas to paper. After managing his parents' Wisconsin farm during his adolescence, backbreaking work he will ever recall as formative and painful, he turned to teaching as the escape from that brutal labor. All the while, he attended to the intellectual currents of his time, fixated by Lyell's geological theories and Darwin's revolutionary vision of evolution. Though raised in a devout Christian home, he is mesmerized by scientific theories that undermine many of that faith's assumptions. Powell lost most of his right arm at the Battle of Shiloh, fighting on the Yankee side, but he never allows that disability to stop him. He led the first known expedition down the Colorado River in 1869, a feat so titanic it sealed his reputation and status for life. The Colorado was truly terra incognita, a blank space on the map of America, an unforgivable void in the national imagination. Powell summoned a motley crew of volunteers to steer wooden boats down one of the most challenging rivers in the world, providing, at last, a comprehensive survey of the mighty life source cutting through the Grand Canyon. That trip, with its heartache and strains, convinced Powell the West could never be viewed through eyes trained by lush eastern and midwestern landscapes.
Ken, I asked you to read that section for two reasons. One is, I've been reading a lot of books about the Colorado River.
Oh,
so John Wesley Powell is a character in my life. And the second is the way that section ends, you know, sort of this east to west perspective. In what ways do you see yourself in John Wesley Powell?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Absolutely. So I've had a kind of complicated biography. I was born in Montana, but in many ways raised in the upper Midwest. I was raised outside Chicago. And then we moved back to Montana when I was a teenager, graduated high school in Great Falls, went to college here at the University of Montana in Missoula, and then traveled, you know, and then we moved elsewhere. We went back to the Midwest for many years. And so for me, I often come at Montana with kind of dual perspective, and it really is a perspective from the upper Midwest and Montana itself. And Powell fascinates me because, you know, when he makes that presentation to the Constitutional Convention, in many ways, he's very blunt. And in many ways, I think ineffective, because what he says is, you're tenderfeet. I, John Wesley Powell, grew up in the way I just read there. It was a tough upbringing. And I bring all of this knowledge, plus he brings an extraordinary vision that we should be organizing our states not by grids and by, you know, lines on a map, but by basically ecological systems. That is, we should organize our counties by how do we get people to cooperate to use the land effectively across these different industries and different life sources. And so when I come back to Montana, having spent time away, I'm always struck by how incredibly beautiful this place is, how incredibly warm Montanans are, but also how tough it is. This is a tough place, and I'm guessing many Westerners listening will agree with this. And I also recognize that we can probably do a lot better at getting along with each other, meaning we can probably do a lot better at having arguments like the one he proposes. Let's have a real basic, meaningful argument about how we're going to occupy or spend time on this land. And is it possible to create a space for alternative ways of living in this place, including recognizing, acknowledging indigenous nations' rights to this place. So Powell is very provocative to me. My hope is that I hope I'm not condescending in the way he is, but I hope I'm willing to consider points of view from other parts of the country.
You end this book with two excerpts.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you'll read both of them.
You bet. So the first, and I'm very honored to share this, Richard Littlebear is an extraordinary scholar and leader. He is president of Dullknife College on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And Richard's a very fine poet, and I asked his permission to share. And I will tell you, in the book proper, the poem appears in both Cheyenne and in English. And of course, I'm going to read the English version of it. And the title is A Conversation with Grandma. You were not the hugging kind, but you've touched me all of my life. One way you touched me, I remember, when we took down our camps from berry picking time every fall, and as we rode home on the horse-drawn wagon, you would look back to the mountains. You would call me by my Cheyenne name, Howling Bird, come home with us. So that is Richard's beautiful poem, and that's just an excerpt, by the way. And then I wanted to conclude as well with one of my all-time favorite historians, writers. His name is Joseph Kinsey Howard, and this is an excerpt from one of the great books about Montana and the West, I have to say, Montana High, Wide, and Handsome. The sunset holds infinite promise. Fire sweeps up from behind the Rockies to consume the universe, kindles the whole horizon, and all the great sky is flame. Then suddenly it falters and fades atop the distant peaks and the lonely buttes, ebbs and is lost in secret coulees. The Montanan is both humbled and exalted by this blazing glory filling his world, yet so quickly dead. He cannot but marvel that such a puny creature as he should be privileged to stand there unharmed and watch. And just to comment on that, why conclude there? First of all, I was very self-consciously using texts, poetry, because both are poetic texts, mm-hmm. from both what we might call an American culture and a Native American culture. I very much wanted both voices in there. Mm-hmm. I very much want to suggest that as we sit here today in 2018, we have to find a way to listen to each other and listen across these cultural boundaries. We have to somehow engage almost in a kind of personal and collective truth and reconciliation, where we listen to the stories of both Indigenous peoples and settlers, understand what motivated or drove those decisions, recognize that we don't have to repeat mistakes from the past, and that we have elders like Richard Little Bear and like Joseph Kinsey Howard, who can help us to kind of set aside some of the venom, the anger, the rage, and listen. And more than anything, we, I think, are so privileged. I agree with Howard. We're all privileged, I think, in the Western United States to live in this extraordinary place. And we should acknowledge that, honor that, and honor our opportunities, too.
Which leads me to my last question, Ken. What's it like to be named one of the most gifted Montana historians of our generation?
Well, that is a very kind statement. That is by Bob Swartout, who is my personal hero. Bob was a longtime history professor at Carroll College in Helena, Montana. And Bob is a great historian of Montana. And it was a very kind note. And I should be clear, Bob helped me to put this book together. He was an extremely important critic of the book. He was pretty tough on me. I showed him the manuscript and he critiqued it. But what I do appreciate about Bob's comment is we're really moving back to storytelling as an important way to take on, to experience history. And I think that is so healthy. And part of what Bob is responding to is the storytelling. That is, hopefully these are vivid stories that will provoke a lot of interesting analysis, thoughts on the part of the reader. So yeah, I'm very, very honored by that. I will tell you though, I hope this book in 1864 will prove kind of entrees into much deeper engagement with history from the area. There's an extensive bibliography, which includes many books or articles, I should say, by Bob Swartout actually. But I hope readers will be drawn into that deeper engagement and go deeper into the meaning of what it means to have dwelled here.
Part two of my question is, in addition to being a historian and also the executive director of Humanities Montana and also a white man, what's the responsibility associated with those privileges in writing history?
Absolutely. Great question. And it leads to really one of the most important things I would say, which is that it is incredibly, I felt it was my moral obligation, my historical obligation, and my obligation as someone who is part of Humanities Montana to represent, to acknowledge, to share stories of Indigenous peoples. But I also recognize that is not my story to tell. So as often as possible, I quote directly from Indigenous sources. When I can't, I try to do respectful paraphrases. But in the end, I would encourage every reader to go to Indigenous sources. They have the stories to tell. But you may well wonder, but why did I need to include them? Because we are all living here together. And I worry at times that we remain almost blinded to the story of how settlement took place and the consequences of settlement for peoples and for animals and for our land. And so I want to be very honest about that. I hope that the book stimulates some very useful conversations about how do we get along. And I used the phrase earlier, and it's a very sincere phrase on my part, maybe truth and reconciliation, where we honestly, frankly encounter what's happened here, take it on, and then move forward.
Is that your vision?
That's my vision. Thank you. That is my vision. Yes.
Ken Egan lives in Missoula, Montana, where he's the executive director of Humanities Montana, our primary support since 2008. Look for more information about his work and Humanities Montana at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.